netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to the FX Podcast for Tuesday, April 25th, from Las Vegas, the first day of NAB. We have some friends joining us tonight in the FX Guide suite here at Caesar's Palace.
I prefer the technology bunker, Jeff.
I'm sorry, yeah. Mike. In addition to Mike and John and I, I'm going to have some people introduce themselves first. Fred?
Fred Ruckle from New York City, Inferno artist.
And I'm Wally Rodriguez from upstairs in Miami, Florida.
So we're spreading out a bit, right?
Like yeah.
You've got New York, Miami, Sydney, Chicago.
Chicago. Sean from Chicago. You can recognize Mike's voice, I think. And speaking of Mike, Mike was on the bus on the way to NAB at 8 a.m. today.
I was.
To make sure that he got there bright and early. And we left in a cab at 8:30 and got there before you.
Yeah. But what the heck?
You saved $1.
Okay, so we're going to do a review of, like, fun stuff we saw at the show on day one. You're hearing this on day two, of course. You're hearing it on Tuesday. We recorded this on Monday. And we've just spent the day at the show, so we're exhausted. But some really amazing stuff, don't you think?
Yeah, especially.
Yeah. So, So, like, I don't know if you guys saw anything interesting. Did you guys see anything really interesting?
Absolutely. I was really investigating graphics technologies. New platforms to look at, new applications to check out, things that have been developed.
It seems that the hardware is really coming around to becoming a lot less transparent. And that's the one thing that's very exciting for me. It looks like the actual hardware is not going to be a much of an obstacle for a while now.
That's really exciting.
As we say in Australia, fuck that. Check this out. I went down to the show floor, had no intention of doing this, and within 25 minutes of getting down there, I bought something I never expected to buy today. I bought a 4K video camera that runs 4K at 60 frames per second, and I bought the same camera runs 2K at 120 frames per second. It runs virtually uncompressed. It's about £7 for the camera without lens. And this camera is absolutely gospel. It's going to be actually released fully at the end of the year. So they were selling, I guess, what you call it, I don't know.
Pre-release.
Yeah, exactly. And this is from Jim, who has set this up. He runs Oakley cameras. Lenses, I should say, and the sunglasses. And Jim himself was there and looked after me personally, which was incredibly nice of him. Super nice guy. He has a metal business card. So what do you reckon it's worth to have a camera that shoots full 4K at 60 frames a second progressive, or it could shoot 25, 24p, 60p. It'll run to a flash drive on the camera that'll hold an hour, or to disk, or it can down-res to SR decks or to anything else you like. It'll even run out in sort of standard HD, do anything else like that. Want to guess how much that would set me back?
Just by your funny face right now, I'm going to say $12.
Yeah, Bong, thanks for playing.
$17,500, and a lens is like $4,700, so it's... As I was saying, it's $22,000 and change for what is an awesome
camera. I guess
camera.
I was a little off.
Yeah. Let me give you an idea of what you're talking about here, right? A normal HD camera is equivalent to a 2.1 pixel sensor. So, you know, you get like a 2.1 megapixel camera. Yep. That's effectively what an HD... Okay, so this camera is the equivalent of an 11 or 12 megapixel camera if it was a stills camera, but it isn't. It's running at 11.4 megapixels at 60 frames a second, and the raw files out of it are the same dynamic range as film.
Very nice.
And so what they get you, if you buy one, and we bought one.
I thought that was it. You were going to take it out of the box and surprise
actually,
you. That's why I said $12.
It's a 4x2 box.
I was like, damn, right. That's an amazing camera.
They actually give you part of your camera. And this is my part. And I'm holding in my hands, for those that can't see.
We'll put a picture on it.
You have to put it together.
It's true. And look, they've even got the serial number. It
looks like brass knuckles.
At FX Guide, we bought serial number 22. You could only buy them at the show, or if you could get the guy that was selling them on the mobile. And as he wasn't answering his mobile because there was a huge crowd around him this morning. But, yeah, that red camera is absolutely astonishing.
So when's it shipping, do they think?
It's going to ship near the end of the year, and it'll take any lens. It'll take bare mount lenses, so you could actually just rent the lenses that you wanted, or they have got a lens that they're going to be shipping with it as standard from the outset.
Yeah, they had quite a line, you know, gathering there, and it was all closed up and stuff. And I walked by, and I thought it was maybe some kind of novelty thing, so just kind of kept going. I should have stopped, I guess.
No, I mean, literally the Mysterium, which is the chip, is a Super 35 Cine-sized sensor. So in other words, the sensor that's the pickup is the same size as Super 35 film, which means that when you put standard lenses on it, you get all the standard depth of field and everything else that you'd want. I mean, this thing is wickedly cool. But just think about it for a second. If you're like a post house and you wanted to pick up some plates or something, you could go out and you'd be shooting 4K, no film grain, and come straight back and use it immediately. I think it's awesome. I'm stunned.
Fantastic. I came out here planning to buy an HD camera already, but now I'm going to have to go check that out tomorrow because it's in the same price range.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, completely unbelievably cool. The major body of the camera has got tons of add-on bolts, so you'll be able to put adaptions on it and everything else under the sun. They're gearing up for large manufacturing runs, so they understand it's being really popular. And so they've, you know, got it ready to go, theoretically.
How's the monitoring? How do you monitor? Does it have a viewfinder built in?
That's the funniest thing. It has a flip-out screen at the side and a viewfinder. So, and it's very, very, you know what, we're going to put a picture on the website.
And when they have an IPO, we should all be in on that one.
Wow. So that's the camera body there. Yeah, and you can see that's in a case, and the case is to put on the various attachments. We'll put a picture of this on the website. But, yeah, I mean, I'm just stunned. I had no intention of buying this, but because we're doing FX PhD, which we'll talk about, I guess, in a sec, we'll be using this for capturing stuff for doing training with and stuff. So that's why we're getting one. And, I mean, I'm just really glad I didn't buy an HD cam or a F900 or anything.
Exactly. Really amazing.
So that would be my wow of the day. And the other thing that was really interesting is that there was a booth there, and we went off to this private booth, which was to show them working with other things, and there was an amazing Apple 2K thing there, a Final Cut Pro running 2K with DPX files. Okay, so what I think we should do is have a look at a clip. Actually, I recorded this. We rocked up at 9 o'clock this morning, actually, before the thing opened, and we're in the queue. I think we were like fifth into the tent at Red, and this was the presentation they gave unveiling it, and so I recorded some of that so you guys can see it firsthand.
Red changes that landscape dramatically. At the heart of Red lives the Mysterium sensor. Here's what the Mysterium sensor is about. 4,520 pixels wide by 2,540 pixels tall. You get data to burn. Data to burn. We call that 2540p. This is ultra high definition. 11.4 megapixels. 11.4 megapixels. 11.4 megapixels. I like to tell this myself at night when I go to sleep. Now, why so much data? Oh, and also more than five times the resolution of $100,000 Pro HD cameras. Now, why so much resolution? A lot of people have said 4K. What do I do with 4K? Well, a simple answer to this. Because the Mysterium sensor physical size is 24.4 by 13.7 millimeter. Anyone knows what that means? Exactly. It's the size of Super 35. Well, it was up there. That's why you knew it. Super 35 millimeter film. Okay? And with that, it means you can use any Super 35, 35 and 16 millimeter PL mount lenses natively with this camera. Natively. Just plug it in. In other words, you get 35 millimeter depth of field, amongst other benefits, in using the world's best lenses. Red also offers option to mount D4 lenses and is announcing today a Red lens.
And Mike, you had made mention of Final Cut running at 2K. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, there's in this special booth thing that they had for the Red camera, there was a special 2K DPX thing set up that was running with Apple. I asked Jim about it, and he said, well, you should go and ask the Apple guys about that. So we actually went down from the Red camera thing down to the Apple booth and managed to get the product manager for Final Cut. And we put a few of these questions to him because, you know, what's the deal? So so we asked him point blank. Can you comment on Apple's role with the Red camera?
I can't comment on any unreleased products or any business relationship we may or may not have at Apple.
So the device they showed us, which wasn't under NDA or anything, right, seemed to be a Final Cut system running 2K in real time.
Sure. There's actually a lot of great 2K solutions for Final Cut. Most notably, the one from AJA, Kona 3. They're showing real-time 2K on the desktop with Final Cut Pro. They've got their own 444 RGB codec that they've developed that works with Final Cut Pro. So Final Cut itself does not natively support 2K nor that camera, but using third-party solutions like the AJA Kona 3, it's certainly possible to put together a workflow that'll get you editing.
So for my money, Final Cut is obviously a huge presence here at NAB. It's been a product that's been growing enormously. What is new at the floor that you're showing?
We're showing, for the first time publicly, we're showing the universal build of Final Cut Pro, which is Final Cut Studio 5.1, running on Intel. So we've got a row of MacBook Pros, including the new 17-inch MacBook Pro that was announced today. Performance absolutely stellar on the MacBook Pro. The Intel performance is just through the roof. In fact, we just showed Shake in the theater doing 2K compositing on the MacBook Pro using visual effects shots from King Kong. So really great performance there. We're also expanding our HD support in Final Cut Pro, so we announced at the show that we are adding support for Sony XDCam HD. And this is kind of a two-part story with the Sony XDCam HD. It'll require a software update to Final Cut Studio 5.1, which will be, you know, coming shortly, and it'll require the ingest software from Sony, which is available separately from them. And then further down the line beyond that, we're doing a technology preview of 24p HDV support in Final Cut Studio. So things like the JVC and the Canon HDV cameras that support 24p shooting modes will be supported in Final Cut Pro.
So one of the other interesting things that are on your booth is actually the Final Touch guys, which have got a color solution that's an XML export from Final Cut into their color grading. And that color grading is obviously 2K and below and comes in a range. But what's really interesting, I think, about that is their use of the GPU and accelerating stuff. Could you comment about GPU acceleration in Final Cut?
Well, we have GPU acceleration in Final Cut Studio through FX plug with Motion. So all of the motion effects are GPU accelerated, and FX Plug is the plugin format for Final Cut Studio, and it is destined to show up in Final Cut Pro in a future release.
So in terms of the workflow, we're moving up in terms of resolution and capabilities, but also you did things like multicam last year and a few other things, and then there's the XML. Now, Apple's been very good at documenting their XML, but how have you found the other players in terms of, you know, the XML into relationship from Final Cut to other products?
I think it's great. You know, this year we actually have an entire row in our booth dedicated to XML solutions in Final Cut Studio, and we've seen the developer community absolutely explode this year with a variety of solutions, everything from simple import and export components to integrated solutions like the Silicon Color Final Touch system to, you know, companies like Sony writing the XDCam HD interface software, which uses both QuickTime and XML to communicate with Final Cut Pro. It's just taken off like wild this year, and one of the reasons it's become so hot is because there are now over 500,000 Final Cut editors. So customers are out there, customers are asking for these solutions, and developers are coming up with ways to implement and integrate Final Cut into a variety of workflows, you know, some of which we may have never even dreamed possible.
Yeah, a really interesting thing, Mike, is that, you know, we've used Final Cut to cut some commercials that were shot on digital still cameras at 1K with sequence shots, you know, and so we've been using Final Cut kind of as a Uber editor thing, and the thing about it is that because the hardware is becoming so much faster, I mean, it's really an amazing thing what they're doing with the speed of the new Final Cut Studio and also the multiple camera editorial setup where you can just kind of click on the camera view. You can have up to 16 cameras in this view. And so we did a whole bunch of shorts for Discovery Channel, and basically we were turning them around in one day, and this is in HDV. So I mean, we had no issues at all. This thing has become a very good tool. We run our company on it. Our editorials are happening on Final Cut, doing campaigns for Royal Caribbean and Anheuser-Busch. And you know, it's definitely not a toy anymore. I can tell
you. Yeah, there were new codecs, weren't there, for the HDV and stuff released as well here.
Yeah, they're faster. And the other thing is that we've had quite a few interesting situations with major Avid followers who've converted and basically will never go back.
I was just going to say, I wish I knew more about Avid, because an Avid apparently today announced some kind of compatibility now in supporting Final Cut Pro.
I understand that there's some kind of thing happening with AAF, and also there's an XML-based interchange thing. And, you know, the thing about it is that I think up to now a lot of people have felt like they're basically beta testing for Avid, because every time they release, you know, a piece of software that's not running on their, you know, built-in hardware or in their proprietary hardware, it's like, man, 3, 4, 5 dot releases later is when it finally settles down, and I think people are getting pretty tired of that. So, you know, for the sake of competition, I hope they're catching up.
Yeah, another XML thing that was really interesting is Final Touch, because Final Touch is basically film grading, and you're in Final Cut Pro, you export the Final Cut Pro as an XML, and then on the same exact system, you run up Final Touch, and then you can just grade it then with primaries and secondaries and everything else, including rotates, scales, and translates. And that's all using GPU stuff. And there are even plugins for that on top. And then when you finish, you XML it straight back to Final Cut and keep working.
I think that whole GPU rendering situation, which arrived rather late to our business. I mean, I would have thought that somebody would have been watching what these gamers were doing,
right. Yeah.
Stuff,
yeah.
You know, 5 years ago. But, you know, fine, it's getting here now, and we're all going to get a lot out of it, I think, because it's going to really change the way we work, especially when you have multiple GPUs in a system, and you'll be able to do all kind of, you know, interesting GPU-based stuff like big 4K images with displacement maps and stuff that we saw.
Did anyone see the Shake demo using the Shake Universal on the new 17-inch laptop, the Intel 17-inch Apple laptop?
I didn't see that. I saw Shake.
They released it today, right?
Yeah.
It was the first. It was really impressive.
Yeah. Releasing some quite speedy. Hardware?
Yeah, I mean, they're actually doing the Shake demo on a 17-inch laptop, because the 17-inch laptop from with the Intel chip is equivalent to the Tower G5s, so it was just as fast
core,
to do the
with the quad core towers.
Yeah, so they were doing it on that rather on the stand. That was like the main Shake demo machine.
I tell you what, man, that Mac Mini it's really fast, and the iMac the iMac G5 is really fast. And you know, I was reading an article on the airplane coming here, and a guy was saying that it was ironic that the first time he ever owned a Windows machine, it was made by Apple, and it kicked the ass of most every other PC he'd ever run. You know, it's a rather amazing thing that's happening here.
Yeah, well, they actually say now, you know, with that whole boot camp thing with Apple, not getting off the subject, but that if you run XP on an Apple right now, it's actually much faster than an actual Windows machine that's native. It runs XP faster than you can run it on a real Windows machine.
It'll run Vista. You can't even find a PC that'll run Vista right now. So.
I mean, I'm hanging out for the, you can just open a Windows app inside OS X.
It happens already. Parallels Workstation.
Yes.
There's like 3 VMwares doing it.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Parallels Workstation. Mm-hmm. It works very well. I'm using it, beta test. And there's another one that's also happening, and it runs very well. There's a little performance hit. It's not like running booting in XP just yet.
Right.
It won't be very long.
Actually, I should point out that for them to run Shake on that 17-inch, they had to, of course, be showing Shake in Universal.
Yes.
And Final Cut's already gone over, but this wasn't actually a release of Shake Universal. So that's still to come, but obviously it's just around the corner because they wouldn't be showing it. But hardly ever does Apple show stuff without releasing it pretty soon.
Yeah, I spent some significant time over at the Shake demo on a tower with a 30-inch screen, which, by the way, is just so nice to see a graphical workspace of 30 inches. It was really nice. But I put them through a whole bunch of different tests, and there was actually a lot of interesting things about it. One thing I found that was really kind of cool is that you can do a contextual painting, and that you can have a composite going, and, you know, being a flame person, we all like to look at context and go back and modify something while looking at the end of the pipeline. So, of course, I had to ask, you know, can you do the same thing here, you know, and show me something like that. But they did something neat, and that it was that they were able to rotate what was going to be a reflection pass for the ground. And when he was painting on that reflection pass, it was in context looking down. But when he painted and pushed to the back, since it was rotated down, the actual brush just automatically would get smaller or larger with the paint stroke. You know, so it felt like you can literally go back into infinite space and go down to a point or all the way big. It was actually really kind of cool.
And we actually ran into Dion, who's with Shake and Apple, and we cornered him and had a chat to him about what was happening with Apple and Shake as well down in the booth. So let's play that clip.
We're this is a technology preview of Shake 4.1. It's running on a new MacBook Pro 17-inch, 2.1 gigahertz, a standard out of the box. It's using the internal drive. And we're showing 2K compositing on it. It runs, it rivals desktops at this point. I mean, you can actually do real work. We're showing full King Kong scenes on it and stuff.
So the Final Cut version has come out for the Universal. You're showing the Universal of Shake. When do we expect to get that in the hands of users?
We don't have a date planned for release right now. It's just a technology preview of it. But it's certainly soon, or else we wouldn't show it on the stage.
So a lot of the stuff here is HD and higher than that film res, and Shake obviously is one of the key pro apps in that area. Can you explain the relationship moving forward between Shake and things like Final Cut?
Well, they're even today they're getting closer together. So half of the things that we're showing on the stage are King Kong, and then obviously to bring it down to a level of people like, well, I don't build King Kong, what does this mean for me? We actually show a piece from a company in Germany who did a Mini Cooper spot where they're using Final Cut and Shake together. I mean, Shake is such a good, flexible toolbox. If a Final Cut user just wants to use it for a keyer or for optical flow retiming or for, you know, color correction, all it is one node. So it doesn't have to be a huge script. And already today it's built into Final Cut where you can say, send these edits over to Shake and it will build the tree for you and then render back into the Final Cut timeline. So even today I think people are starting to be aware that it's not just Lord of the Rings, King Kong type stuff. If you want to do anything with high quality, especially as people move up in Final Cut to 2K or in HD, you know, they're realizing what benefits Shake has, and it doesn't have to be a full-scale tree. It can be as simple as one node.
So one of the things about Shake is that even at the SDK level, it doesn't handle time particularly well in terms of accessing into a clip. It's very, very good in many areas, but obviously one of the areas that it's not as strong in is temporal stuff. We see this both in what can be done by the plugins, but also just in terms of Shake itself. It's obviously not got an editing kind of component to it. Hence the role with Final Cut. I want to just ask you how close you see that moving forward, because is Final Cut going to be the solution for dealing with clips, or do you see that being something you want to look at in terms of Shake itself as a standalone?
I think today, absolutely, Final Cut, for people who want to do more temporal twice stuff and use Shake, that is absolutely the workflow for that. Because of the way Shake is built right now, that's what the way it is. Final Cut is a great editor. You're not going to replicate that in any other application. I mean, Final Cut is what it is. It's a great editor, and people are going to use it for that. So we're not going to rebuild the wheel in Shake. You already have Final Cut.
So with Motion, we saw GPU stuff producing sensational performance. Now we're seeing stuff happening with, Final Touch, which is running on the Apple box, where it's taking stuff from Final Cut from Final Cut in and using GPU processing to get high performance. I mean, is there any reason Shake couldn't start being GPU-based for fast performance?
I mean, you've seen GPU performance are really fast things since Quake came out, right? You can take... Quake will play really, really fast. I mean, you can do things, you always could do things really, really fast. That was never the model of Shake. Shake is the model of, we're not going to do a few things really, really fast. We're going to let you do anything and deliver the highest possible quality. So in some areas of Shake, where like in the multiplane node, you do see some OpenGL acceleration. But in the final render, it's using a software solution that you can distribute on different computers and get the same results back. And so that's just the model of Shake. Just lets you do anything and delivers high quality.
So another thing I just want to mention with Apple is this week, I believe it was this week, for the first time, is a new DVD series that produced by, in conjunction with Peachbit and FX PhD, regarding the Shake SDK, which Mike's been working on for the last several months, actually.
Yeah, Peachbit does all the Apple training stuff for Apple, and they do really good stuff. I'm sure we all have one of those books either on Final Cut or Shake or whatever. And we teamed up with them to do the Shake SDK, which is a intense training three-disc set on how to do stuff in the SDK
with Angus, who did a series of lectures worldwide on this in about six cities, and we thought it'd be a really good idea to be able to offer that to everybody. So actually, Dion has a rave about it. We should play that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting story. We actually did a semi-world tour of Shake SDK, and it was really targeted at Shake users to get a little bit deeper, because a lot of what people find interesting about Shake is how much flexible interface it is, but also the scripting language that you can get into, and the fact that the SDK isn't really a set of APIs, it's actually down to the metal into the engine, so it's a really broad, deep SDK that lets you do almost anything you want in the application. So we got a lot of feedback doing these, although it was targeted at the Shake users. A lot of people came back saying, we really want to learn more about it. You know, we don't have Shake today. But also, because Shake has free render licenses, you could distribute those anywhere on any Mac at any time and use the SDK to build things on top of it. So it opens it up to a whole bunch of new people.
So where can people get a copy of the Shake SDK? And just explain what actually it is.
So the Shake SDK is it's a 3DDB set. It goes through everything from the basic SDK of building small plugins to elaborate plugins and how to build new input nodes and things like that. So you can actually build your own nodes or link into asset management tools. And the Shake SDK is done by Angus Taggart, who's the developer of the SDK. So you're getting actually firsthand knowledge on this 3DDB set, 6 hours of instruction, all about how you can go in and customize Shake to suit your needs. So it comes with slides and the presentation. It's really in-depth, and it's exactly what we did on the world tour to the end users of Shake.
So there's a funny story there that someone came on board to help Angus, and they turned up at the first day, I presume they were in some part of Apple, to help with writing SDK stuff. And someone, I think it was you or Angus, said, if you want to learn about the SDK, review this and see if there are any bugs in it.
Yeah, no, we absolutely used it to train people who came on board to work on the SDK. It was used as a training device. And luckily, they didn't find very many bugs at all or changes. So it was great for them. It got them up to speed really quickly. But even if you're not a Shake user and you can use the free render licenses, you can then use the SDK to build stuff on top of it. It's available now at Peachpit and at Amazon.
And we didn't set him up to say any of that, did we?
He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Well, you know, I think it's pretty exciting, the whole FX PhD thing, to have, you know, this kind of resource coming from people who've been doing this kind of work for a long time, especially because the other choices out there are pretty disorganized and kind of unpredictable. You never know what you're going to get or when it's coming. And so I have to say I'm pretty excited about it, and it's going to be a great resource for us, because training is our single biggest problem right now. You know, the documentation and stuff for the systems has changed so much, and, you know, we have really old tutorials for some of the software that we use, and, you know, so it's going to be really nice to have not just good training tools, but very contextual in terms of the business, you know.
Yeah, that's a very important thing, I think. I mean, I've always been a manual person. I've, you know, from the very start of my career, I've always had every manual and read them, actually. You know, most
no way.
Most people don't ever. They're like, I just figured out. I'm like, did you know there's like a button that does what just took you 12 steps? You know, and I'm the guy that reads for all those shortcuts. So, you know, training things, we also have all those different types of things, like total training and stuff for everybody in our office to bring home and learn stuff, and all these different types of training programs that we all seem to like.
Yeah, I've been really happy with the response. It seems like
it's been phenomenal.
Yeah, it's been really good. So, I remember scurrying over there to see how many people had looked at the site. You know, a couple hours after it had been online.
Just remember us when you moved to Tahiti. You know, to the private island,
which would be still FX PhDing from. I put it point
yeah,
out.
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's the wonderful thing.
It would probably be as cluttered with technology as this room is right now.
We could open up the training center there. That would be cool.
Yeah, people would come.
I come to Fiji.
What about the yacht idea you had of having a yacht?
It sank. The yacht sank, man. I'm so mad.
We were going to have a training thing on the back of a yacht. No, when I say back of a yacht, it was a yacht big enough to have a helicopter.
Yeah, we were talking about renting this yacht that had a helicopter pad on it, and it had all kind of goodies, and we were hoping that Discreet would pay for it, but
well,
you know.
us and about 45 of our friends, I should point out, we can't afford it
back in the old days.
It was actually it was a pretty. I think it would be still a pretty neat idea. I mean, they fill up a whole cruise ship to do Photoshop training, so maybe you know.
Yeah, there you go. VFX training. Well, we'll put that in the plan.
VFX PhD will happen in the back of a rowboat for now, and then later on, as it grows, then we can be on the yacht. You
know? I got to say, with PhD, we've had a really great reaction from the equipment manufacturers as well, and it's really come on board because they see the need for that training stuff as well. So we've got some really exciting stuff in the pipe, and some of the people that we've got lined up as professors in the course, it just
God, it's gonna be great.
Yeah, it's good.
So check it out at fxphd.com. Not dot com, but dot dot dot.
You know what? I think this audience is pretty technically literate. I think I'm going to get
I'll figure that out.
So other things like graders. Could there be any more graders on the market right now?
There's more color correction than there is color.
There's like Assimilate, Final, FilmLight, Nucoda, Pablo, Final Touch, DaVinci Resolve, and 2K, and the new option for that, which is... I've forgotten, but really cool. And Luster and...
Pandora.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot.
And someone Thompson made Bones. I think they have Bones, right?
I spoke to one of the equipment manufacturers today, and they went, do you think that everyone that's going to get into DI has already done it already? It's like, well, I was going to say that, but, you know. I don't know, how big is the market for DI?
Well, you know, I think that if you look at, if you look at it in a different way, for example, I'm coming from a totally different situation where I probably will never deal in DI at all. But what's really interesting to me is that, you know, we've had clients asking us to put in Telecine for a long time because in our market, there's six machines and they all suck and the operators that run them pretty much all suck. I mean, it's
how do you really feel?
We go out of the market a lot.
No Floridians are listening to this.
So, yeah, don't take it personal, guys. Anyway, the point is that we feel like what's going to really be a driving force here for the TV commercial market in a medium-sized environment is that you no longer have this million-dollar investment to put in a Telecine and then another $200,000 a year to have an engineer to maintain it and another $150,000 to $200,000 to have the operator. So if you really concentrate on the operator and the hardware, I feel like you're going to have dailies done the way they've always been done for a while. And then basically we'll scan the selects and grade the selects, and it's a totally different approach than the DI situation, but very much in context with what we think is going to happen to the medium, you know, size markets, and then maybe even some smaller markets when you look at tools like what you were talking about in Final Cut, Final Touch.
Well, somebody pointed out to us today that a couple of years ago, if you had asked for that video stuff, they were all saying they could do it, but they didn't have all the tools in there. Right. You couldn't do the video stuff properly, interlaced, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And now they're all doing it. They're all gunning for that market as well. So,
well, definitely. I mean, this is a big, huge market that I think is being ignored, and that is the boutique-type situation where, you know, you have the whole pipeline there except for film transfer. And, it's going to be a matter of a good artist now instead of... having the resources to put in $1 million Telecine, which will be outdated very soon.
Yeah, we took a moment actually today to drop by the FilmLight booth and talk to Andrew Johnson, who's the head of sales and marketing. So,
there's some really interesting stuff there. Yeah, we should hear this.
Yeah, let's take a look and listen to what he has to say.
There are three sorts of people buy our stuff right now. There's the DI market, which is effectively done, right? Most people that want to get into DI are pretty well there. Then there's the visual effects houses that we're starting to see buy into this stuff. So, for example, Double Negative in London have a bunch of our products. And the third place is the video guys. And they fall into two categories, I suppose. There's the people, good examples would be in London, Envy and Nats, who are just video. They have no interest in anything else. And typically their position is they're starting with some SD gear, you know, a Pogel or a DaVinci, something like that, and a Telecine. And they've got to make an investment to get to HD, and that brings them out to the market. And then they say, well, if it goes quickly enough and it's software, then it's worth me looking at this new stuff. But they really won't compromise on a quick thing. So if you think back a few years, the closest analogy I would point to would be the Quantel discrete analogy in the very early days, right, where you had Quantel, which was worked out of the box. You know, loads of people knew how to use it. Clients asked for it. And discrete came along when I was at discrete at that time. And it was flaky, but it was exciting because it was software, it was on computers, and people felt that was a more open approach. And that has been where the software grading people have been for a while, including us. didn't really do video very well, wasn't really quick enough, didn't do audio, you know, field rendering, oops, you know, all that sort of stuff. But that's cracked now. And most of the suppliers around the show floor are doing software grading systems to crack those issues. With the base site, these big base sites, we crack the performance stuff as well. So we have a genuine pitch of those video-only guys. And then there's people in the middle who are video, primarily video for aspirational or video and doing movie of the week or whatever else.
So yeah, one of the really interesting things to me for that is the infrared stuff. I mean, that just that's like new, right? Like this year.
Yeah, no, just coming out. We saw that yesterday at the Autodesk user group meeting where they use that and some motion estimation technology to clean the dirt out of a piece of negative. Basically, it's a pass that shows you where all your dirt or scratch might be in your negative. And I get the concept of what it's doing, but I have no idea where they get this infrared pass from. And that's one thing where Andrew kind of clued us in on.
So pristine color film is completely transparent to infrared light. So if you do an infrared pass and you see a defect, anything in the infrared raster that you get, you've got something on the film that is not an artifact in the image. It's not a highlight or a glint or anything else. It's a problem with the actual physical film. So what this does is it means that if you've done an infrared pass on a piece of film, you have a matched raster with the infrared pass in the picture, and that gives you 100% accurate, no false positives match of where you've got a problem on the film. Now what that does for a cleanup process, like a dustbuster, like a Forge or a Pixel Farm or an MTI, is it takes all the guesswork out of finding the defects. So not only does it go quicker, but you get no false positives. What that means in turn is you can automate the process of dust busting to the point of getting a clean plate, whatever your pain threshold might be, without manual intervention.
So how does that actually work? I mean, you've determined that there's something there that obviously isn't in the image. It's going to need to come out, but you're not getting it out. You're just flagging it for the next point in the chain. So what gets passed literally from one box to the next?
Literally what happens is a DPX file with a raster embedded as part of the DPX standard. We're able to put a raster in as well, and we do that. So right now, MTI, Pixelfarm, and Foundry are all supporting that format. It's a published format. You can go on the web and download it if you want. And they're doing their miracle stuff downstairs.
Where
with motion.
Where do they download it from?
From our website.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it's completely open.
So what I really like about that is that they're not actually repairing anything. All they're doing is saying, you know what, I can effectively give you a pass that shows you where the dirt is, put that in the DPX file, as he said, and then hand that off to whatever we want to use, if you know what I mean, to fix it. We could be fixing it in Luster. We could be fixing it in anything. I think he mentions there he was fixing it in also in Foundry stuff and somebody else.
Yeah, using...
It's really good. It's
yeah.
really
yeah,
it's very nice.
Bright technology.
He said that the threshold actually for pain for... dirt is actually probably going to change because of this, because right now we just accept stuff because it's so hard to get every little speckle of dirt
yeah.
out that you accept it more. But with this, there's no excuse. It's just, it's so easy. There's no, you can back engine it, the whole thing.
And you know, it really links into Wally's point about having a film scanner, because we actually spoke to him about this, the issue of how hard is it effectively to put one of these into a facility that maybe isn't a clean room telecine type company. It's maybe a graphics effects house. And this is what he had to say.
Oh, it just takes the space of the scanner. It's just not a big deal. We have people running these scanners in palatial marble-clad rooms and people in London running them in cupboards, literally in cupboards. And you need the air filter. You need to do that. Some people will go as far as positive air pressure. Others won't. It's, you know, it's very interesting. And it works 24 hours a day.
So that's really interesting, Mike, because basically what he's saying is that you know, it's opening the doors to a lot of places that would probably not even consider this kind of technology to you know, basically implement a film scanner and not have the huge expense involved with, you know, positive airflow rooms and all that kind of stuff that was related to the whole film scanning situation even a few years ago. And with the easier, you know, access to dust busting tools, you know, it's even a little bit less, you know, picky about it, you know?
So I guess the big question is whether you shoot it with a RED or scan it with a scanner like this. And the big winner in all of this is just storage.
That's yeah. right. And it's storage everywhere, man. Everywhere you turn around, there's discs, there's, you know, serial ATA and you know, SCSI over ATA and all this kind of stuff. I'm, like, totally lost. But I'm looking forward to 4 gigabit storage and fiber, and you know, it's going to change for us. It's going to, you know, help a lot to be able to put those kind of multi-terabyte setups in a facility.
Well, surprisingly, I actually went by Atto's booth, which, you know, we all know as Atto is like the original people. We think of RAID from years ago. Atto was like big in RAID. They actually had a really nice device that was basically a chassis that had fiber channel capabilities, but at the same time was for people making the transition from SCSI to fiber. So it would allow you to put SCSI drives into it and come out fiber. And, you know, it could hold a ton. I mean, based on the size of drives you can buy these days, you know, this couple of rack unit space could be like 4 terabytes, you know, of SCSI. So when you're transitioning and having older drives, trying to get into 4 gigabit fiber, you know, they already have it planned so that you can at least put the infrastructure in there. And then when all of a sudden you're finally, okay, I'm done with these drives, you can then turn over to full fiber.
Yeah, but not only that, transition. But, you know, we're talking about enterprise level reliability here. And that's just another little step towards making the whole hardware situation rather transparent to the production side of the industry, which up to, you know, a little while ago, hardware was just as important, if not more. I mean, you spent a lot of money just keeping the hardware.
Certainly. But the storage thing also, you know, when you think about how much storage has changed, and even like Mike's talking about this camera that can record all this data, and all of our digital still cameras that have all this data and storage, and where do you back up your backups of a backup?
That's the biggest problem.
Terabytes are not near line,
and then near line, and then you have offline, and then you have, you know, some robot at the end. You have some guy, you know, basically making tapes still.
It's a mirror of a drive of a driver, you know. And
so I'm looking for those optical cube drive thingies that you're gonna have that you can carry like your whole life on a keychain and stuff.
Well, that's where I was hoping for that holographic versatile disk that's supposed to be coming out. And you know, that's kind of one of those up-and-coming technologies. That's 1 terabyte on a CD-sized disk.
Oh, yeah. Well, something has to – I mean
– with fiber speed.
There has to be some breakthrough soon and all that stuff, you would hope, because, I mean, the number of tapes we fill up on backing up one shot in a film.
Oh, it's crazy.
Or, you know, and the funny thing to me, we get – I mean, scans now in Hollywood. Everything's FireWire. Everything moves around town on FireWire drives now. You know, volatile, drop it.
Yeah, I mean, and FireWire is definitely not bulletproof, not just in terms of the hardware being dropped or whatever, but, you know, the connectors start getting messed up. And, you know.
I mean, I guess the theory is it's scanned on a RAID, it's going to end up on your RAID when it gets there, and it's all just – it's just transport. So,
you know, we made a practice of putting a little FireWire extension on every FireWire port that we use so that we don't wear out the machine's port, and instead we plug and unplug out of a 6-inch extension.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
Yeah, so one thing we saw that was really interesting about with SANs and that kind of stuff is SAN accelerators. In other words, they put like between 250 gig and about 4 terabytes of RAM in between the SAN itself and the SAN switch, which basically means you get vastly higher performance out of your SAN.
Wow.
It's Exavio. I think it's exavio.com. And we'll put a link of that on the website. But that was pretty interesting. You know, really upping the amps there on your SAN. And the other one that you were talking about before about sending stuff across town and stuff. Has anyone seen the software IP accelerators?
No.
So these are like basically trying to move stuff. It's like a... This is now not inside the facility. This is a cross-town kind of thing.
Yeah, pushing stuff.
But they can really up the rates across IP, though someone told me that sometimes some IPs see them as a denial of service attack, and so you can have some issues. But, you know, if you think about it, if you got 1.5 megabits a second, that's HD, right? So 3 would be dual link. So once you can get up to, like, 10 gig E and stuff, we don't really need video cabling because we can just be...
Right.
10 gig E, it's like, you know what, I mean, I can do multiple HD, I can do HD 444, and I can just use standard switching gear.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, you know, we, you know, in our new setup, we're going to have a switch that basically is just for wiring between our flames, you know, which is kind of like the way they're doing it now. And you know, we were watching some soft import tools reading 2K frames over gig E with no problem. I mean, you know, it's all going to, you know, and you know, you can buy gig E switches for almost nothing now.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, really, the infrastructure part of the whole thing is really, I mean, I kind of keep bringing that up. But the thing about it is that as a company owner, the whole hardware situation was becoming rather daunting. And right now it looks like some huge fucking doors are wide open to do some pretty pretty amazing stuff with basic hardware, you know.
Right.
So that brings up that sort of root question, doesn't it? Are you better off having a lot more people on cheaper systems, or having really amping up each system and, you know, having... I mean,
well, that's a big question.
You guys have staff working for you. I mean,
I face that one. I mean, I'm in the process right now of negotiating upgrades and where do I go at the next stage of, you know, I have an Onyx 3000 and do I buy multiple graphics stations like you just mentioned, or do I upgrade this one station for the cost of my one upgrade?
We're in the same situation. We've been holding on to our Octane 1s forever, and we're, you know, literally taping them up and Frankensteining them from, you know. Swear to God, we have some, you know, we have some pretty Frankenstein-looking stuff in there.
eBay runs a lot of this industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we bought like 5 Octanes from, you know, Videotape Associates and basically stocked them up so we could have enough hardware to survive the Linux transition. Which, by the way, I mean, I'm very pleased with the way the whole thing's happened. And, you know, the code base is so exactly the same that even the same bugs appear on the Linux. Or I should call them features.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're features when they're there for more than 5 years.
The truth of the matter is that, you know, we are, you know, as a small company, up and coming, trying to figure out what's going on, we've had probably the most heated conversations in my partnership about this, you know, because it's very tough to convince someone who's on the sales side of the equation, who's used to looking at numbers in terms of, you know, what do you get out of it, convincing them to put another $250,000 into our facility that could literally put, you know, a major workstation at every desk, including our secretary's desk, you know. So how do you go about that? Well, I do have one thing that sheds some light in the situation, and that is that we still work with a lot of supervised sessions. And to us, that plus the integration of the software, which there still isn't a package out there that's as integrated as Autodesk products. I mean, it's getting there. There's some pretty big, good nibbles out there with, you know, After Effects 7 and stuff.
After Effects and that whole production studio they put together is a pretty big bang for the buck.
After Effects is, I mean, you used to think about, you know, the major competition to a Flame as being, at one point it was a Quantel, right? But, I mean, it's a freaking After Effects box, right?
Yeah, I love it.
And, you know, I'm doing all kind of stuff at home in After Effects, and not only that, but the other interesting thing is that as that delta starts getting smaller and smaller, you know, how do you justify it? And to be honest with you, probably for our company, we're gonna make the investment this time because we feel like we still don't have a way to do it in any other way that's good for session work.
Well, somebody accused me of being a Flame lover last night, so I'll say this, playing devil's advocate. The other thing is, it's not just the cost of the box, right? I mean, has anyone tried buying plugins for After Effects versus buying plugins for a Flame?
Oh, yeah. I went over that today. You can buy the whole entire Sapphire set for After Effects for less than the cost of upgrading from one version of Sapphire to another on a Flame and Inferno.
Right, or to Linux.
You know.
It's funny you should say that because we spoke to Carl today. This is what Carl had to say when we asked him about that stuff.
Pricing varies, and it kind of depends on the market and how much effort it took for us to make the plugins work on it.
And in terms of like what's been happening with the plugins, can you give us the now sort of the broad brushstroke of all the different boxes that you support? Because I kind of lose track. I mean, I think of After Effects, Discrete, and possibly Avid as the three main ones. Is that correct?
Yeah, those I think are the three main ones, but After Effects also includes a lot of other platforms that support After Effects plugins, like Final Cut Pro and Combustion and Digital Fusion and Quantel indirectly also. There's also Shake, which is its own plugin architecture.
So anyone see any cool plugins on the show floor?
Yeah. In fact, we were lucky enough to get grab at Correlate, which is one of the new Foundry ones. It's only in Discrete's Foundry 3 stuff, mm-hmm. and it was actually an example explaining it on fxphd.com. So there's a free download, little explanation of it, but it's I guess it's like motion control, really. You can shoot a clean pass or a cleanish pass, and it'll line the second clip to the first clip. Have you guys seen it?
I didn't get to see it, Mike, but I just saw the demo you're talking about, and one of the things that was evident to me from the demo, which I hadn't thought about, was that most everybody's thinking about this tool as a fixer-upper tool, but it also has some interesting artistic possibilities, like, for example, the example of having the same artist and the same actor in two places and that kind of stuff. And the first time I heard about this, I really had the whole mindset of, well, yeah, I can fix all kind of stuff. But, you know, it also has these kind of interesting side effect with, you know, very artistic. Somebody could really take advantage of this tool in an artistic way as well.
Yeah, I think you could do some, you know, good pre-planning before a shoot, and you could set it up so that you can do things like this and use the plates and work it out as an effects tool as opposed to a fixer-upper.
Without
like
spending all that time in motion control.
You would,
I mean, if you can
money,
get something close,
know.
I just hate. I mean, I just,
on set, and you're just there, and everyone's just standing around, and they're like, why are we doing this? It's like, well, we need motion control.
It yeah, just always seems to be a process.
Yes, and so seldom do you get motion control things where there's like a bump or a little thing that was on the track.
Yeah, and so if you could do a, you know what, I mean, if you have a good grip and you do a very similar pass on like a dolly or whatever,
yeah,
then all you need is something like that to pull it back into alignment. I mean, you know, it's going to not be perfect, but...
The thing to think about is trying to do that by hand.
Oh, yeah, it's such a nightmare.
I mean, so that's
yeah, and you know, a lot of times, you know, we deal with memory head type situations where you have an automated camera head that can do a lot of repetitive stuff. But you know, just there's so many times when it's just that little bit off,
yep,
and the little bit is the hardest part to get back in place. And so I can see a lot of interesting uses for.
Well, as we show in the QuickTime, it's also doing matching color, right? So if your exterior
sure,
and the clouds have shifted a little, and you're trying to do a paint back, and
yeah,
you know the just doesn't match.
Yeah.
Right.
And so the fact that it's doing a match grade, as it's also doing a Chronos temporal adjustment and a motion estimation, global motion estimation alignment of the frames, you're aligning in space, time, and color. I love them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, I love the whole motion estimation technology and what that
brings. Did
they
say how
us.
Much it's going to cost?
I was going to ask that next.
Well, I don't know. You know, it's Foundry, it's Furnace 3, right? So I've already got Furnace 2, so... 3 was like an incremental upgrade, but I can't tell you the exact pricing. But it's only in the flame version, not in the shake version, because the shake SDK doesn't allow us to, or doesn't allow anyone to really get into clips and do temporal stuff that well. But hey, I got one really big question to finish with you guys, and this is probably the most important thing. Did anyone find any really, really good giveaways at the show?
You know. No, but I do got to tell you something, Mike. You know, talking about these kind of tools that are opening up some interesting possibilities, you know, Monet and Moki have actually come of age pretty well. And in this show, you know, I'm really impressed with the work they've done, especially in Monet with the whole planar tracker. And, you know, they're dealing with lens distortion. They're dealing with reflections and shadows. And, you know, we had a pretty interesting experience where a rather tough shot was done so much faster than we could have even thought about because we had been working on it for a while that, you know, I wanted to mention those two tools that are also coming of age very nicely. And they're running on multiple OSs as well.
So for people who don't know, Moki is effectively a planar tracker that would identify, say, a car against a moving background and let you get a map for the car. But Monet is really, well, you know, it's developed by, like, Framestore, I think, with the picture frames in Harry Potter.
Right.
You know, when they go up the stairs
yeah,
and the paintings
yeah,
are all
uh-huh.
moving?
Right.
But use it for, like, label replacement.
Right. I mean, and the thing about it is that it's very good at doing things like tracking a surface that's going out of camera because it can grab the whole thing but slowly concentrate on just the part that's left. And, you know, especially the fact that it can deal with lens distortion and, you know, and that kind of stuff, it means that if you're tracking a TV screen or if you're doing anything like that, it really I'm very impressed with what they've done with the tool.
You know, it's really interesting. The whole point about the Monet is that if you've got a picture under glass, it'll identify
the
reflections,
right.
So you can replace the picture
yeah,
under the reflection.
And it doesn't even have to be shot on, you know, anything special. I mean, it did it over weird green with some weird tracking crosses in it. And, I mean, it really did a very good job of knowing what to mess with.
But see, my thing was, and I said this to the guys, it's like, this is so cool, and I love it, it's great, but if you can identify the reflections and put a picture under it, can't you identify the reflections and remove it? And I was like, surely you should make a plug-in version of like Monet, the car.
The car fix.
Yeah, the car fix.
Yeah.
And then you just track the car and it would work out the reflection on the car and remove the reflection. Because how long do we go around?
I know, that's one of the things that we do a lot of because we do a lot of cars. And yeah, that's very interesting.
So anyone that goes down to the Monet booth, say to them that you're listening to FX Guide and they want a car option.
The car button. It's next to the one-legged chicken button. Make sure that if you see that one-legged chicken, it'll put another leg on the chicken so nobody will get, you know.
So as far as fun things I saw, well, as far as good little giveaways, I really didn't spend too much time looking into that because I had such an agenda of looking at graphic stuff.
No, whatever.
The one thing I did take that I had a few.
The giveaways at the pool are nice.
I was diligent. I worked all day long, really.
Yeah, give the guy a break, man.
But no, I did find Jolt gum.
Jolt gum.
It's a caffeine gum, right?
One piece of gum is equivalent to a cup of coffee.
You gotta love it.
Gotta keep that away from the 3D department.
I was like, wow, okay. I had
some. It was called Jet Black. I bought it in Japan, and the cool thing was that on the label it said for a highly technical flavor. I just thought that was very cool.
Yeah, apparently Da Vinci have really good pens. Though I haven't got one yet, but. You know, call out to Carl. Our friends at Da Vinci. Carl has lasers, and there's quite a few T-shirts going around.
I didn't pick up a single thing.
Really?
I just was just too busy trying to learn about everything.
And just to point out, if you buy a red camera...
You get that card.
If you don't necessarily get the card, but you could if you ask Jen nicely. But you definitely get a bolt section of your camera. It's an ultimate giveaway, right?
It's basically like, you know...
Hey, one thing that I did see that was cool is... The Sony 4K projector, that sucker looks great.
Yeah, I tried that. It's thing was really closed when I went.
And I also saw in a little corner near the Draper booth a black screen projection, a black projection screen. You had totally beautiful blacks in a fully lit convention center.
How does that work?
I'm not really sure, but it was a rear projection on a black screen. And what they're doing is they're using filters to generate pure color. Pure red, green, and blue. Sony's doing this too with their black screen. And the screen is designed to only reflect pure colors. Therefore, it rejects most of the ambient light, which is kind of composed of a lot of different wavelengths. And it's very interesting for those of us who have, you know, who like, you know, projection and stuff.
Is that like that reflects media stuff that looks gray and then it's only blue with the... Oh, is it
no,
angled?
It's designed to reflect only pure...
Does it matter what angle you're looking at?
Apparently not, because I walked around it and I was very impressed by it, especially this one that had no visible, you know, shading of any kind. It's a projector firing into a first surface mirror and right onto the screen in the middle of the show. It was very good.
Where's that?
It's next to the Draper booth, somewhere back there on the second floor.
Southern Hall?
I can't.
South Hall. I used to have a memory. I barely got it there.
It's in the South Hall. If I remember correctly, on the second floor.
Okay.
I did notice that a lot of manufacturers have multiple booths this year.
Yeah.
Huge booths, but some of them have multiples. I'm like, oh, wow, you guys got a really tight booth.
And you know what's
like,
cool?
We got four others. I'm like, what?
I mean, kind of a sidebar. It's cool that a lot of the small vendors are kind of interspersed amongst the big vendors. There's no, like, you know, back of the room place where all the little vendors are.
I got a sweet spot this year.
Yeah.
Right inside the front door in front of Apple.
Yeah.
Between Avid and Apple.
Yeah, that was good. And I sat there for Fusion, and I got to say, it's a nice...
The demilitarized zone between Avid and Apple.
Yeah. Exactly. But I got to say, it was really loud, and I will say I kind of wanted to take a picture of the guy that was in the front of the demo when I was sitting for a Fusion. Apple's booth was so loud that he was sitting there at the front looking to the side, watching what was playing on the Apple screen while sitting right in front of the demo artist for at least a few minutes. And I'm going, God, this guy's so rude. He's watching their demo while this guy's demoing for him.
Apple gave good demo.
Yeah. It was definitely interesting. But Digital Fusion, you know, it had a lot of stuff. The guy that was there was demoing the Gatorade spots that are playing all
They're
really
nice guys, the Fusion guys.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And, you know, they're all about attacking technology. You know, they don't say you're confined to this computer. They're all talking about, you know, you get the new box technologies, multi-proc machine, we're going to be on it. You know, they're not saying you have to be on a specific one or two computers. They're basically open, which is nice for people like Juan and myself who are like, I got to buy something that's going to be viable. Oh, okay, I can move it on to another machine. It's not going to be a problem later. Great. Right. You know, because those days, you know, they kill you when it's a mammoth investment. And this tool, Digital Fusion, I mean, I was on them about 10 years ago, maybe even maybe even a little longer, when they just started, and the guy sent me a CD to check out, and he hand wrote on it Digital Fusion. You know, it
was, you know, they started in Sydney, like,
did they?
Right where I work. Yeah.
Oh wow. Look at that. Well, I mean, they're really nice guys.
In technology.
There is, but the guys there were intelligent too.
Yeah, they're great. We're talking to them later this week, actually.
Yeah, I was nothing but impressed. There's nothing worse than going to a booth and knowing what you want to ask. I mean, we're all educated people. We all know what we like and need to know, and they all have the spiel of what they want to throw you. And I'm like, listen, this is what I know I need to know. I don't need all the glamour things you want to paint out. This is what I need. Does it track like this? Does it have this kind of gear? And these guys are able to point on answer everything you need.
You know, I've got to say, if you can talk to the engineers in Autodesk, in Apple, in Fusion, they're really nice guys.
And you get the answers, and you know they feel they like the fact that people are asking smart questions about their stuff because you know otherwise, what is it? I mean, it's not worth it.
And I got to tell you, we cane them pretty hard sometimes. Yeah, and I mean, if there's a bug in there, it's like but you know they're. Yeah, no, I've got a lot of time for the engineers.
And you know, I'm very pleasantly surprised about the fact that there is, you know, noticeable forward motion in terms of image processing but in the practical sense, there's definitely a lot of really interesting stuff out there that's taking advantage of stuff that, you know, really, I mean, the infrared stuff is amazing. All this GPU-based processing is pretty cool. And the fact that they're actually giving people time to work on this shit so that we actually get it one day, you know.
They could just work out at the convention center how you could get a decent cup of coffee.
But you can get Indian food now.
Okay. Well, guys, thanks so much for hanging with us.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, especially those people that have been joining PhD today, which has been... We love you.
Exactly.
No, it's been really good. So, tomorrow, guys?
Yep, we'll put links on the page for all the stuff we've talked about in the article that accompanies this podcast. So, if you want to check out Moki or Red Camera, we'll put links up there for you.
Cool.
And we'll go back and hit the big floor tomorrow and come back with more.
The 2 million square foot exhibit hall.
I heard
there's a lot to talk about.
Cab driver told us they're doubling it. They're making it 4 million.
God, it's
We're five guys out of 120,000 here in Vegas for the show. It felt like it when I was trying to get a coffee this afternoon, I can tell you.
For real.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.